Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. For years, a recent report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services provides a stark warning about the state of our natural world. It also gives us a strong message. It is not too late to make a difference. According to the report, as many as a million species risk extinction in the coming decades due to human-related activities. There are an estimated 8 million plant and animal species on Earth, but over 1 million are at risk of extinction. The 1,000-page global assessment on biodiversity included 15,000 scientific and government resources compiled by 145 experts from 50 countries around the world. The report is the first major international review of the planet's biodiversity in 15 years. Species loss is accelerating at a rate faster than ever before. Nearly 600 plant species have already vanished. Twice the number of mammals, birds, and amphibians combined have also been wiped out. More than 500,000 species on land do not have long-term habitats and are at risk of losing them if they're not restored. Activities like farming, logging, poaching, fishing, and mining are altering the natural world at a rate unprecedented in human history. Prominent conservation ecologist and one of today's guests, Professor Stuart Pimms, says the report asks a very important question. What kind of planet do we want to pass on to our children and generations to come? Stuart Pimms is professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. His research covers the reasons why species become extinct and the global patterns of habitat loss. His commitment to the interface between science and policy has led to his testimony to House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. And Professor Stuart Pimm joins us from Duke University in North Carolina. Hi, Professor Pimm. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We are also joined by Pamela McElwee, one of the lead authors of the report. Dr. McElwee is associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science, and Dr. McElwee is joining us from New Jersey. Hi, Dr. McElwee. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you. Thanks to both of you. This report is the first large-scale global assessment on biodiversity since 2005. This is a huge report compiled by hundreds of international experts based on thousands of scientific studies. First off, Professor Pimm, can you give us some background about how this report was put together?
Absolutely.
I think the clue about this report is that it's not just documenting biodiversity and the fact that species are going extinct 1,000 times faster than they would do without, you know, human impacts, but it's beginning to make the connections to why biodiversity is important, the ecosystem services argument, what nature does for us. And what nature does for us is a whole variety of interesting and wonderful and very valuable things. So I think the strength of this is putting those two ideas together.
And Dr. McElwee, what would you tell us about the background, really, about how this report was put together?
Yeah, just to echo what Dr. Pimm noted, this is incredibly important because it provides really state-of-the-art evidence to assess where we are in terms of biodiversity. But I would also note that one of the really interesting features of this report is that it was put together by this organization that you referenced, the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, which is an intergovernmental system. That means scientists and governments together work to create the assessment and then approve it. And so governments have buy-in to this report. This is not just a report that, say, an environmental NGO put together. This is something that governments were intimately involved in. And so for that reason, I'm optimistic that we may be able to see some policy change coming out of this as well.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious parallel here is to the IPCC, the International Policy Platform on Climate Change, which was similarly put together a lot of different stakeholders. There's not a lot of new science in this report, but there's a lot of consensus, and I think that's its strong point.
And Stuart, these are massive reports, and when we read about them in the media, we get excerpts here and there, but if you spend some time really looking at the report, I mean, it's exhaustive. So can you talk just a little bit more about how the research is done and what really goes into this?
I think there are some, you know, there are some key numbers. And what this report does, and what the climate change reports before it have done, is to give degrees of certainty about what we know. The report, at least the press release of the report, talks about 8 million species. We're, in fact, very uncertain about that. We do know what fractions of species are at risk of extinction. We have great certainty about that. For a limited number of species, we know how fast they're going extinct. We have considerable certainty about that. And then there are the sort of the various economic reasons and ethical reasons. And they too are varied. So it's basically, you know, how much biodiversity is there and what's it worth to us? And the report breaks those two overarching questions down into lots of different pieces and gives an excellent overview about what we know well and what we are much less certain about.
And what would you add, Pam?
Yeah, I would agree with that. One of the things that we were charged with when we started the report more than 3 years ago now is to really provide an update about the status and trends in nature and really hone in on what the indirect and direct drivers of change might be. And one of the things the report does is, for the first time, is rank those drivers of change as to their importance. And so there are five primary drivers of change in biodiversity and ecosystems, the most important being land use change, then direct exploitation, that's hunting and fishing, directly exploiting species. The third most important driver, and one that's going to be, we think, increasingly important over time, is climate change. We're starting to see the impact of that on many different species now. And then the final two drivers that we ranked were pollution, that's particularly important in marine systems, becoming very important in terms of plastic pollution affecting various marine species, and finally, invasive alien species. So we see that, for example, in the United States, where our Great Lakes have an enormous problem with invasive species like Asian carp.
Well, Pam, since you brought up those three, let's dive into those. According to the report, I mean, these numbers are just hard to wrap your head around. Nature across most of the globe has now been significantly altered by multiple human drivers, with the great majority of indicators of ecosystems and biodiversity showing rapid decline. 75% of the land surface is significantly altered. 66% of the ocean area is experiencing cumulative impacts, and 85% of wetlands has been lost. So Pam, as a non-scientist, most people are not scientists, when people read these numbers in the news, how do you make sense of this? Even just talking about the land surface, that 75% of land surface has been significantly altered.
I think what's really important about the report's perspective in pointing out all of this significant alteration is it really brings home to us that we humans have a choice, that we can continue on the path that we are on, which is to create all of these changes leading to biodiversity loss and decline, or we can choose a different path. And it's really up to us, because we are the significant driver of all of these changes through all of our various actions. So we need to step away from the idea that the planet is so vast and that we can't have such a large impact, because that's simply not true. For a long time, for example, people assumed that oceans were so vast that the human impact was fairly minimal. And this report points out that's not true at all, that there are very few portions of the ocean that haven't seen significant human impacts, particularly in just the last 20 or 30 years. So we've seen a rapid acceleration of these human impacts in just a very short time span. And so that really should drive us now in understanding what sort of choices we need to make that are different moving forward.
I think some of these changes are... Sorry, go ahead.
No, Stuart, go ahead, please.
Okay. I think some of these changes are really obvious when you look around. Go to your supermarket and look at what kind of fish are on sale there. Now, I grew up in the north of England, and comfort food to me is cod and chips. Well, it's been a long time since I found any cod. The supermarket shelves are covered in farm-raised tilapia, farm-raised catfish, farm-raised salmon. The amount of wild-caught fish that we're seeing is only a small minority of what we eat. It's a measure of how extensively we have devastated the world's fisheries. Another rather more technical way, but immediately accessible to everybody, is to go onto the web and look at Google Earth. Google Earth is this global set of satellite images. The first thing everybody looks at is where they live. And you look at where you live and look at how much wild area is, you know, within 5 miles or 10 miles or 1,000 miles of where you live, and you very, very quickly see the extent of how we've changed the land.
You also brought up climate change, Pam. Can you tell us more about what the report says about how climate change is affecting species extinction?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's a growing threat. I mean, one of the things that this IPBES report does is really highlight the importance of climate change as a driver, and it really adds on to the report that came out from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, last fall. And that IPCC report focused specifically on the problem of trying to hold climate change to 1.5 degrees since industrial times or less, and pointed out that we're essentially on a track whereby we're not going to meet that goal. We're going to exceed it. We're talking about warming of 2, 3, even maybe 4 degrees Celsius or more by the end of the century. So we're not doing a good job in eliminating that as a driver. And so our report simply gives even more reason for us to want to tackle this head on. It's a problem for biodiversity. It's a problem for specific species that are adapted to certain climates and simply can't migrate. We're learning a lot more, for example, about the ability of certain species to modulate temperature changes. A colleague of mine here at Rutgers, for example, works with fishing communities, and they're on the East Coast here in the U.S., and they're noticing shifts in fish ranges as fish are moving primarily northward or to deeper waters to escape the warm temperatures that have been increasing in oceans recently. And so that's going to be having for the human populations that depend on fishing rights and the availability of fish. So climate change is instigating all sorts of changes. And unfortunately, our report and the IPCC report from last year both point out that we're on an accelerated track. We're not doing nearly enough to slow down the rate of climate change.
Stuart?
You know, when I come to California, I'm not a fan of spending my time in the big cities of San Francisco and L.A., I like to get up into the mountains. I like to get up into the Sierra Nevadas. And, you know, you hike up into those absolutely wonderful mountains, and you think that they are so fantastic and they're so pristine, and you enjoy the wildlife there. And one of my favorite animals is a little furry mammal called a pika. And pikas are having to move to higher and higher elevations. They're engaging because they're very social and they're very noisy and they're cute, and those poor little pikers are being driven higher and higher and higher to keep cool. And that process is indeed, you know, one of the challenges to species extinction. It's not as much as not as important as land use changes, which are massive, but it's definitely something that we appear to have very little control over.
And I would add that our report makes a couple of other conclusions related to climate change that should really catch people's notice, and that is that there's certain ecosystems that are much more vulnerable than others, the obvious example being coral reefs. They're very vulnerable to both temperature changes and the changes in acidity, which have accompanied climate changes and our increasing amounts of carbon that we're putting in the atmosphere. So certain ecosystems we know are very vulnerable. The second thing that we should be worried about is that climate change is favoring the evolutionary strategies of certain species. So we can think of things like mosquitoes. They are evolving resistance to efforts to control them. And some of this is driven in part by climate change and other land use changes. And so we are essentially putting our hand on the lever of evolution and accelerating some of these processes that might have taken thousands and millions of years before.
However, could I interrupt and ask,
sure,
can we talk about what's encouraging about this report?
Sure.
Because it's not all gloom and despair and misery. There are wonderful things that we're doing.
That's right. Absolutely. That's an important point to point out.
Well, let's talk about some of those things.
I think one of the most obvious... Yeah, thank you. I think one of the most obvious ways is that we are now protecting much more of the planet than we used to do, both on land and in the oceans. And, you know, 30 years ago, it was something like about just a few percent of the land surface. But countries around the world are now setting aside more and more of their land and the oceans in protected areas, national parks and the like. And that expansion of protected areas has, you know, has a huge impact. In many ways, for many of us, the big event or the bigger event is not this report, but what happens next year in Kunming in China when the Convention on Biodiversity meets under Chinese chairmanship to try and set goals for how much more of the land and the ocean that we're going to protect. There are explicit biodiversity goals. And that's where the international community can really step up to the plate and make decisions about minimizing human impacts.
And what would you add, Pam?
Well, I would add that we also for sure know that protected areas can be effective, but we also know about other success stories. And one example of that are the efforts by indigenous peoples and local communities to conserve the lands that they live on or manage or have done so traditionally. The report provides really strong evidence that these communities are doing a better job than other places at conserving their local biodiversity through various strategies ranging from cultural practices that conserve certain species to restoration efforts that are sometimes linked to things like language revitalization. So there's some really exciting initiatives that may fall out of what we think of as formal protected areas, but they're also being very successful in helping to retain biodiversity and ecosystem function for the long term.
I agree 100%. If you look at the Amazon, for example, it's not the formal protected areas that protect the Amazon. It's the indigenous reserves there. And I think what this tells us is that, you know, like politics, all conservation is local, that we have to work with local communities, empower them, enable them to find alternative ways of having a living and at the same time protecting their environment. The non-profit iDirect Saving Species is totally committed to making sure that we help local people. We are not one of these organizations that feels we do our best work in air-conditioned offices inside the DC Beltway. I think you've got to get out there, as my colleague on this phone call does in Vietnam. You've got to get out there and you've got to work with communities and you have to figure out what they need.
That is Stuart Pym. He's professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. His research covers the reasons why species become extinct and the global patterns of habitat loss. Dr. Pam McElwee is one of the lead authors of the report. She's associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science. And today we are talking about the United Nations Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services report. It provides a stark warning about the state of our natural world, and it gives us a strong message that it's not too late to make a difference, but we have to act, well, sooner than later. And we talk about this on a regular basis on this show. If you have any questions for our guests about this massive report, what they found, the hopeful points, and what changes they'd like to see, and what you'd like to see, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Pam, can you tell us more about the work that you do in Vietnam and how Vietnamese specifically adapt to a changing climate and preserving their nature and wildlife? What really stands out for you?
Absolutely, yes. I'm getting ready to leave for field research in Vietnam in just a couple of weeks. I've been working there for the last 20 or so years, and they're really emblematic of the challenges that countries face in conserving biodiversity and ecosystem services. They've been growing rapidly in terms of their population size. People are also becoming wealthier. So I've seen amazing changes in just the last 20 years that I've been doing research there, going from a very, very poor country post-Vietnam War to really close to a middle-income country now with increasing prosperity. But all of those changes have essentially come at the cost of a lot of their ecosystems and loss of specific high-profile species as well. For example, there used to be a subspecies of rhinoceros that lived in Vietnam, and the last known individual of that population was poached a few years ago. So they're really facing serious challenges with involvement in global wildlife trade, which is driven to a large degree by consumption not only in Vietnam but elsewhere. It's what we would call a telecoupled pressure. That is, it's a trade pressure that connects different parts of the world. So they experience that in Vietnam. They've got an incredibly long coastline, and so they're experiencing sea level rise issues linked to climate change and the way that that's changing some of their coastal ecosystems, including making estuaries more saline as salt water moves inland. This is also affecting drinking water supplies for people who live on the coast. They no longer have as much fresh water to access for their households. So these are really pressing issues for people in Vietnam. It's not something far off in the future that they have to worry about. And so the government and local communities are really having to aggressively try to put measures in place to try to stem some of this loss, but it's been incredibly challenging. They have a number of protected areas, but it's not enough to just have the area designated. You have to have the money and the commitment to actually make those protected areas work. You have to have buy-in by local communities who see the value of protected areas and see the value of continuing to maintain certain traditional practices that might contribute to long-term conservation. And this is all in the face of these added pressures of climate change or international trade and so forth. So it's a real balancing act, and one of the reasons why I enjoy going to Vietnam is it really shows me how intense those pressures are and how people really have to balance these, because ecosystems are not just about sort of preserving something and fencing it off. These are things that affect our everyday lives. So the water that we drink, the air that we breathe, all of this is modulated by ecosystems in the areas where we live. And so acknowledging those connections and trying to put in place policies that encourage those connections, that's a real challenge, whether you're in Vietnam or you're in the United States.
How did you get involved in working in Vietnam?
I was a graduate student in the mid-1990s, and Vietnam had just opened up to foreign research. It was closed for many, many years post-Vietnam War. And the U.S., in fact, had a trade embargo with Vietnam until 1995. We couldn't even do business, or it was much harder for Americans to travel there. And so it opened up right at the time that I started graduate school, and it seemed like an amazing opportunity given all of the environmental challenges that the Vietnam War had contributed to. And so I just sort of took the dive and went to Vietnam and fell in love with the country and have continued to work there ever since.
Wow. Dr. Pam McElwee is one of the lead authors of the report that we're talking about from today from the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And it provides a stark warning about the state of our natural world. You can read the report and also media reports about it at yourcallradio.org. Dr. McElwee is associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science. Dr. Stuart Pym is professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. His research covers the reasons why species become extinct and the global patterns of habitat loss. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour on 1A, the topic of discussion will be the threat of deep fakes. That's 1A coming up at 11 o'clock on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our One Planet series. Every Monday we talk about the natural world and what is happening to the planet. And you can find our shows at yourcallradio.org. A couple of weeks ago, we did a show about the new film, The Pollinators, which is about what beekeepers and others are doing to save the bees. We also talked about California's deadly fires and how state officials are preparing. Today, we are talking about a new massive report from the UN warning that over 1 million plant and animal species are at risk of extinction over the next couple of decades. And if you have any questions or comments about this, we would love to hear from you. We have two incredible guests who do extensive work on this issue. Dr. Pam McElwee is one of the lead authors of the report. She is associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science. We're also joined by Dr. Stuart Pym, professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, where his research covers the reasons why species become extinct and the global patterns of habitat loss. Dr. Pym, since we were talking about what is happening with indigenous peoples and just how they manage nature and how the local communities in general do a better job, what else would you like to point out? I mean, we talked about Vietnam. You briefly talked about the Amazon. Is there any other place that you'd like to talk about?
You know, earlier I talked about the fact that when I go to the grocery store, I find that the fish is mostly farm raised, and it's farm raised from fjords in Norway or Chile or, you know, various other places around the world. So I can get my fish from anywhere, but if you are poor, wherever you are in the world, you are likely to get your food, fuel in the form of wood, whole variety, your water, you're likely to get all of those things from very, very close to home. This is most true of what when we talk about indigenous people living essentially traditional lifestyles, but it's true of large numbers of people around the world. And so they depend on nature. They depend on biodiversity. They depend on nature services far more critically than we do. So empowering them, helping them make decisions that will lead to an alternative choices is vital. A month ago, I was on the border between China in Yunnan and Myanmar, formerly Burma. And you look across the river into Myanmar, and all of the forest is going up in smoke. People are chopping the forest down, burning it, doing it every year to try and get a little bit of fertilization from the tree ash for their crops. And of course, when it rains, it all washes into the river. China has done, in that region, a better job of suppressing fires. You can see the border of China from Vietnam through Laos to Myanmar to Assam in India very clearly if you look at the satellite images of fire. So the question is, we have alternative choices. We know that local communities depend on nature more than we do. You know, how can we help those local communities make choices that don't involve them destroying biodiversity?
Can you talk about some successful stories where that has happened?
All the work we do at the nonprofit I direct, Saving Species, involves local communities. We help local communities restore land. We consider ourselves to do CPR, connect, protect, restore. We help people reforest landscapes so that we can establish the connectivity between once isolated patches of forest. In the mountains of Colombia, that means that we're reforesting hillsides that otherwise would wash away when there's a severe rainstorm. In other places, we are restoring degraded cattle pastures that really generate more income by growing carbon, by growing trees, than they ever would by growing scrawny cattle. There's a lot of interventions we can do as long as we engage local communities and make sure that they're doing the work, that they're the players, they're making the choices.
Pam, you talked about how in certain countries we are now seeing more wealth. And so you have people living in the middle class where they did not before. And that results in so much more consumption, you know, especially when you look at meat, for example. So can you talk more about that? Because it's just, we're in such an interesting time. There's more information than ever before about the changes that we need to make. At the same time, you're seeing a lot more consumption, a lot more meat eating in places where it didn't happen. So how do you square those things? How do you think about those things?
Yeah, the report really tackled those head on. We hear a lot about the need to think about population growth, but really the report said one of the big things that we need to focus in on is rising consumption, particularly unsustainable consumption. And that means all sorts of things. You mentioned rising amounts of meat eating. That absolutely contributes both to biodiversity loss as pasturage is cleared from former forests, but it also contributes to climate change because the loss of those forests loses us a carbon sink. It also contributes to climate change in the sense that livestock production can be a contributor of methane, which is one of our greenhouse gases. So livestock have a sort of double whammy on our system. And so we know that particularly for wealthy countries, excess meat consumption has not only these environmental impacts, but it also has health impacts that are worth paying attention to as well. Rising rates of obesity and other health problems that are associated with meat consumption cost our economies billions of dollars a year. And so is there a nexus maybe that we could think about reducing meat consumption not only to get the environmental benefits but also to get health benefits for us as well? This is going to be something actually that's going to be in the news a lot in the next couple of months, because there's a new IPCC report, the very next one that's coming out, which will be in August, is on this very question. It's how do changes in our land system, including our farming and our livestock systems, affect climate change and vice versa? And I was lucky enough to be a lead author on that report as well. And so it's been a really nice synergy for me to see both of those reports raise this question of consumption, because it's so crucial to understanding what a better pathway forward might be.
Well, we would love to have you when that report is on, because what we have seen is, you know, 10 years ago, government officials and a lot of environmentalists really didn't want to touch this issue because they would say, well, we don't want to tell people what they should and should not eat. But that has drastically changed over the last couple of years, definitely in the last year. What do you think about those changes?
I think it's, you're absolutely right that people are willing to tackle it now, because we know that this is a major driver. The reason why land use change contributes to biodiversity loss is because we're trying to produce more food, more livestock, more goods for people to consume. It's not just a function of population growth. So the report, the IPBES report, really says we need to do things to tackle overconsumption. Now, there's certainly some places that are still underconsuming. As Dr. Penn was referring to, there's a lot of very poor areas in the world where they're not getting enough meat, they're not getting enough protein. So I'm not talking about those areas. I'm talking about the places that are overconsuming. And there's things that we know that we can do, right? I mean, I think there's a sense that there are things, there are levers that we can use to tackle overconsumption. We can do everything from better pricing, that is using taxes and other financial mechanisms to make overconsumption more expensive. Another thing we can do is tackle the problem of waste. One of the reasons why we continue to consume so much is we actually waste a lot of our food that we produce. It's been estimated that we waste and throw away about a third of the food that we produce globally. So in some places, that waste happens between the farm and going to market. That's particularly the case in a lot of developing countries. In other places, the waste happens at the consumer's end. So there's efficiency before food gets to the consumer, but then the consumer buys too much and wastes food. And that's much more the case in the United States. So there's things we can tackle throughout that chain to figure out how we can reduce that waste, and in turn, we would not need to produce as much food. So that's a sort of low-hanging fruit that we could try to tackle almost immediately.
What would you add, Stuart?
I think the problem is a quite general one. And I eat meat, but I don't eat a lot of it. But I think very carefully about what I eat, and whether it's if it's fish, whether it's sustainably harvested. I make choices about when I go shopping. I don't use plastic bags for my groceries. I just take cloth bags with me. And I make, you know, 100 small-scale changes like that to my life. I walk to shops when I can that have no major impact on my life, or else make it better. And I think you get to the point where you realize that as a species of 7 billion of us, we're going to have to make these choices. So why not make the easy ones first, make the choices that involve less waste, you know, healthier habits. If we rich people in America and Europe can do that, we can massively reduce the impact that we have when our activities, you know, impact the poorer countries from which we get some of our resources.
Dr. Stuart Pym is professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, and Dr. Pam McElwee is one of the lead authors of the report we're discussing today from the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. According to the report, as many as a million species risk extinction in the coming decades due to human-related activities. Dr. McElwee is associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science. Another basic question for both of you You know, for the naysayers out there, and unfortunately we have a lot of those in the United States, especially within the Republican Party, you know, they would say something like, how do we know this? We cannot know this so much about nature. So how would you respond to that? How do scientists establish the extinction rate of species to begin with? Stuart, you know, can you take that one?
Yes. It isn't hard. It's a death rate. You know, we talk about death rates all the time. You know, how, you know, 8 people per 1,000 die per year. It's the same thing with species. The natural death rate of species should be sort of between 1 in 1 million and 1 in 10 million species every year. So that's the natural death rate. What we can do then is to go to the reports of species. When was the species first described by a scientist? You know, Linnaeus started describing species in the 1700s. He named beautiful plants like Magnolia and Strelitzia after his friends. He named some ugly plants after his enemies too. And what we can do is look at the time from when a species is born, if you like, becomes known to science, until when it dies. And those death rates are on the order of between 100 and 1,000 species per million species per year. And that's how we know that species are going extinct 1,000 times faster than they should. It's like looking at the number of people in cemeteries and knowing the size of the town and deciding whether that's a safe place where you would want to live.
What would you add, Pam?
Yeah, I would agree that one of the things the report points out is that we're accelerating these processes much more seriously than in previous decades. Like, this is all a process of acceleration across species extinctions, across rising consumption. We're just seeing that rising human footprint across so many different areas. So one of the things the report does is try to assess, for example, what we call nature's contributions to people. Other people call these ecosystem services, but it's essentially what nature does for us. It provides us clean water. It provides us pollinators, which help us grow our food. And so the report looked at nature's contributions to people across many different areas. And we looked at 18 major categories. And most of those are in decline. It was only a few categories like food production that have actually been rising, food and energy production. Those are things we get from nature. Those have been expanding. But that expansion has come at the cost of all these other things that nature does for us, regulating water supplies, the quality of water, helping us formulate soil so that we can grow our crops on them, regulating extreme events, having mangroves in coastal areas that help prevent storm surges from hurricanes and so forth. So all of those other things that nature does for us are in decline. And so the overall picture that we see from both the species and the ecosystem standpoint is that human pressure is contributing to loss of functionality, and that we really need to tackle that head on because it affects all of us.
We know a good deal about where species are. I think that's an important point. We know, for example, that Colombia in South America has 20% of the world's birds in only 1% of the land area, which incidentally makes Colombia the absolute top choice of bird watchers who want to go and see those birds, which is important for tourism. And so we do know that there are critical places like Central America, like the Northern Andes, like South Africa, like Madagascar. We know that there are critical places around the world where the most vulnerable species of animals and plants are concentrated. And, you know, going to the satellite imagery, going to Google Earth, you can see what's happening to those places. And you can see very directly that the places that are really important for species are taking a hammering. But in that is a solution, because it means that we can concentrate our efforts to save species there.
Well, and we'll talk about solutions in a minute. We're almost at the end of the show. And I also wanted to ask you both about plants, because this finding in the report is making separate headlines. The report found that 600 plant species have disappeared over the last 200 years, which is twice the number of the disappearance of birds, mammals, and amphibians combined. What are the causes of plant loss? Pam, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I mean, the drivers that I outlined earlier, land use change, direct exploitation, climate change, pollution, invasive species, these are all things that contribute specifically to loss of plants as well, particularly land use change. When we convert, say, a forest into an agricultural landscape, that usually comes with a loss of species diversity. So those are all major drivers, and it's really important to point out, as the report does, is when we think about species loss, we may think about sort of iconic or charismatic animals like pandas and so forth, but it's really other species like plants and fungi and insects that do so much for us. They help feed us. They help keep diseases away from us. They do many, many things for us, and we don't recognize that. And so one of the things our report wants to do is highlight those other important species that are so fundamental to helping us survive.
I think that report that came out a couple of weeks ago by a group of authors, including those at Kew Botanic Gardens in Britain, is just an outstanding piece of work. I was fortunate to see it as a reviewer when it was being considered at Nature. It really does do an incredible job of documenting plant extinctions, and it confirms both the estimates that my team has done that species of animals are going extinct 1,000 times faster than they should. They found a comparable number. But it also confirms the fact that there are these critical places, northern Andes, coastal Brazil, Madagascar, South Africa, where species extinctions are concentrated. And therefore, that tells us that we need to be putting our concentration of funds and effort into those, what we call biodiversity hotspots.
Well, we have about 4 or so minutes left. Let's talk about solutions.
Well, the first thing we have to do is stop doing foolish things. We don't need to chop forests down on steep mountain slopes. We don't need to over-harvest fishing, which doesn't give us any benefit, in fact, harms things economically. We need to look at the places that matter. We recognize that those places are often habitats that are fragmented. So they've got little patches of forest here and there. We reconnect them up, which is what Saving Species, my group, does. There's a lot of very straightforward things that we can do, as well as making, you know, modest but sensible changes to our lifestyle.
Pam, what would you add? What changes would you like to see?
Well, for me, the report got a lot of headlines about species loss, but for me, it's actually, I think, in some ways a very optimistic report, because it does present a number of solutions. In the summary for policymakers, which is essentially the executive summary, the short version of the report, at the very end of it, there's a table which talks about what are different countries, localities, individuals, companies doing that have positive benefits for biodiversity. So there are things that are going on. And I want to highlight maybe two areas that are a little bit different from what some of your listeners might expect from an environmental report. One of them is that our cities can be part of the solution. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are in the urban area of the Bay Area. And so cities can play an important role here as well. So, for example, if we densify our cities, if we concentrate new development in places like brownfields, inner cities that may have lost population, that reduces our need to extensify our cities and move them into wildland areas. That's particularly important in California, of course, because as cities and suburban areas extend into the wildland interface, you run up against problems of wildfires and so forth. So cities can play a really important role. We need more green space in our city. We need more green infrastructure in our cities. This is using trees and so forth to help protect our water supplies, our stormwater drainage, and so forth. We can use those urban spaces, green spaces, to encourage more interaction with nature. That gives us mental health benefits in our cities as well. So cities can play a really important role. I really want to emphasize that. And the second thing the report does is talk about the larger structural changes that we really need within our global economy. We don't want to put this all on individuals. As important as it is for us to make individual lifestyle choices, there are things that we need to do structurally. Companies need to, for example, be held accountable for waste. Right now, if you're a company and your product comes in single-use plastic containers, it's the person who buys your container's responsibility to recycle it, but they might not have the opportunity to do so. There may not be recycling facilities. So if we change that equation and required more companies to do what we call the circular economy, so they're responsible for the whole life cycle of their products, that might make it much easier for us to tackle things like plastic pollution. So our report really doesn't shy away from those big issues that may seem a little bit farther away from biodiversity, like economies and cities, but they're fundamentally important for how we tackle these ecosystem problems.
You know, Pam, while you were talking about consumption, you reminded me, I was reading a story recently about how Amazon shipped over 5 billion items worldwide through its Prime service just in 2017. And so if you can think about all the boxes and then the cars on the road that are delivering those, and this is just one company.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and so we don't have great models right now for how do we incentivize companies to encourage people to reduce consumption, right? That eats into companies' bottom line. So I don't want to pretend that this is an easy solution. It's going to be really hard to tackle, but it requires both individuals to make decisions to consume less, but also companies to be held more responsible for the outcomes of their business models.
Right, and I'd love to actually have you both back to talk specifically about that. Final thoughts from you, Stuart. We have about 30 seconds.
I think the big challenges for stopping biodiversity are going to be how we in the United States and Europe engage countries like Colombia and Ecuador and Brazil and Madagascar and China. They have most of the biodiversity. We need to work with them and encourage them to look after their natural areas as best we can.
Dr. Stuart Pym is Professor of Conservation Ecology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. Dr. Pym, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Dr. Pam McElwee is one of the lead authors of the UN report and associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Science. Dr. McElwee, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the report and share it with friends and colleagues at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.